Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, who examines Israel's assassination of high-level opponents and the danger it could provoke a wider Middle East war, ensnaring the U.S. Ralph Nader, four-time independent presidential candidate, who talks about his new book titled Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country that Works for the People. And Justin Mazzola of Amnesty International USA, who discusses the campaign pressuring President Biden to grant 79-year-old political prisoner Leonard Peltier clemency, which is likely the indigenous activist's last chance to gain freedom. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Biden administration is supporting a new round of peace talks in Sudan to end the civil war and one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. In mid-August, the U.S. will convene talks in Switzerland between Sudan's army and the rival Rapid Support Forces to revive long-stagnant efforts to end a conflict that's resulted in as many as 150,000 deaths, almost 1 million people on the brink of starvation, and 11 million Sudanese displaced. The Rapid Support Forces, which emerged from the Janjaweed militia attacks on civilians in Darfur 20 years ago, has seized territory near the borders of Ethiopia and South Sudan. There is growing fear that Sudan's civil war could spread into contested territories in the Tigray region in Ethiopia. Human Rights Watch has accused both sides in the war of committing widespread atrocities, including mass rape, torture, and civilian massacres. According to Foreign Policy magazine, the key to a peace deal may rely on regional actors, including China, Russia, Serbia, Turkey, and the UAE, ending their supply of weapons to the warring factions. This November, Nevada residents will vote on a constitutional amendment to require voters to present a photo ID to cast a ballot at the polls or a mail-in ballot. If adopted, Nevada would join 36 states in requiring voters to provide identification to vote. The measure is being pushed by conservatives in the state who say they're worried about people casting fake ballots. To amend the state constitution, Nevada voters would need to approve the measure twice, this year and again in 2026. According to a recent poll, 84% of registered Nevada voters support the proposed voter ID amendment. A national poll conducted by the Pew Research Center found 81% of voters also approve of voter ID laws. This, despite false charges of widespread election fraud that are used to justify voter ID requirements. Voting rights advocates argue that research reveals that these laws actually block many legitimate voters, especially those who are young, Black, and Latino, from casting ballots. The Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School and other voting rights organizations released a survey in June, which found that nearly 21 million voting-age U.S. citizens currently don't have a valid driver's license. The voter ID campaign has long been part of a larger Republican Party and right-wing strategy to suppress the votes of groups that historically support Democratic Party candidates. In her early days as a chemist working for the 3M company, Chris Hansen was given an unusual assignment. She was tasked with collecting blood tests looking for traces of chemicals produced by 3M in popular products, including Teflon, Scotchgard, and Scotch-Ban. These fluorochemicals, also known as PFAS or forever chemicals, were sold in 16,000 products made by 3M over the decades. ProPublica reports that in the late 1990s, Hansen and her team discovered that forever chemicals were widely found in blood samples collected in the general population. 20 years earlier, 3M had conducted tests of these chemicals on animals, which were found to be highly toxic. An internal company memo from 1979 concluded PFAS were certainly more toxic than anticipated, but despite the danger to human health, 3M increased their production of forever chemicals. In 2006, the EPA accused 3M of violating the Toxic Substances Control Act for failing to disclose the harms to human health from fluorochemicals. 3M agreed to pay a $1.5 million penalty without admitting wrongdoing. In April this year, the EPA announced new regulations requiring every municipal water system in the country to test for and limit the presence of 5 PFAS chemicals within 5 years, the first time these toxic substances have been regulated at the national level. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Not long after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned home after addressing a joint session of the U.S. Congress, Israel's unpopular leader ordered multiple assassinations of opponents across the Middle East that derailed Gaza ceasefire talks and provoked calls for revenge. Israel's claim of responsibility for the July 30th assassination of Hezbollah's military chief in Beirut was followed the next day by a bomb attack in Iran's capital that killed Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh, a key figure in Gaza ceasefire negotiations. Iran accused Israel of carrying out the attack that killed Haniyeh. Both Iran and Hezbollah have vowed revenge, and there's growing concern that Israel's targeted assassinations could engulf the Middle East in a dangerous and costly regional war. In response to the threats of retaliation against Israel, President Biden ordered the deployment of an additional fighter squadron and more warships to the Middle East. There's speculation that Netanyahu's strategy behind ordering these high-level assassinations may be an attempt to draw the U.S. into a wider war against Iran. On August 5th, 7 U.S. military personnel were injured after a U.S. airbase in Iraq was attacked by rockets fired by an Iranian-backed militia group. Your reporter spoke with Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Here he examines the motivation behind Israel's recent assassinations and the looming threat of a wider war that could ensnare the U.S.
Netanyahu wants to remain in power in Israel, and if the war ends in Gaza, then his political career will end, his coalition will collapse, and because he's under investigation for corruption charges, those corruption charges will kick in once he's out of office and there's a high likelihood that he will go to jail. So in Israeli media, they're openly talking about how Netanyahu has sabotaged ceasefire talks in the past and that he's constantly trying to make sure that this war continues and expands precisely because it's serving his personal interests. But beyond that, I think there's other reasons as well. First of all, the election of Pezeshkian in Tehran created a small window of opportunity for renewed U.S.-Iran diplomacy. Netanyahu has opposed talks between the U.S. and Iran, was a very fierce opponent of the nuclear deal that President Obama negotiated and has in the past done everything he can to sabotage U.S.-Iran diplomacy. By assassinating and truly humiliating the Iranians on the day of his inauguration, a reasonable calculation is that his intent partly was to close the window of opportunity for U.S.-Iran diplomacy through this act. Moreover, this occurred just days after he had returned from Washington. And I think he noticed quite clearly that Kamala Harris was sending a very different public signal to him in regards to the conduct of his war in Gaza and the slaughter that is taking place there. And in the press conference they had and the private meeting they had, clear indications that she was much firmer with him than Biden ever had been. And he left realizing that the deference that Biden had shown him, it was now coming to an end, and that he would not be able to continue to drag the U.S. into various conflicts, but also constantly relying on the U.S. bailing him out internationally, politically, and militarily. But by escalating tensions now, before the elections, before Kamala Harris potentially becomes president, he may be creating a crisis that will deprive a future potential Harris presidency of the type of maneuverability that she otherwise would have, the ability to take her own initiative. Instead, she will be cornered and she will be forced to react to the crisis that he has created and forced to get into this automatic knee-jerk support Israel mode that Biden has been in for the last 10 months if he manages to dramatically escalate tensions. So all of these different things combined seem to have created this moment of opportunity for him to kill any potential U.S.-Iran diplomacy, prolong the war and stay in power, and corner a potential Harris president to make sure that she will not be able to easily put pressure on him to end these wars and push him to pursue a different policy.
Trita, I wanted to ask you about the U.S. response here. As President Biden sends warships to the Middle East in response to Israel's assassinations and the threat of retaliation from both Hezbollah and Iran, what are the trigger points here for Netanyahu's plan, if it is his plan, to provoke a response that will irrevocably involve the United States in a new conflict?
So there's several different ways that the United States may get dragged into this war. First of all, the U.S. has already said that it's going to protect Israel against any retaliation by Iran and Hezbollah. This is despite the fact that Biden had earlier told Netanyahu that the U.S. will not defend Israel again if it takes more provocative and offensive action. Netanyahu nevertheless did this, and Biden is nevertheless coming and saying that he's going to protect him again, but apparently told him once more, don't do this again. But every time he tells Netanyahu, don't do this again, Netanyahu defies Biden, and Biden nevertheless defends Netanyahu. Now, if the Iranians retaliate, and the retaliation is quite significant, and Israel decides to escalate further, and this ends up becoming a very heavy exchange of fire between the two sides, not only is there a risk that the U.S. will be dragged in because the heavy toll on the Israeli side may force the United States to start attacking Hezbollah, Houthi, and other forces in the region on its own, which then definitely will trigger significant attacks by these groups against U.S. bases in the region. But even short of that, there is a risk that U.S. troops will come under attack in the region. We still have about 50,000 troops across 17 bases in the region. And these different Syrian and Iraqi militias have attacked these bases in the past. They have killed Americans there before. They want the United States to leave the region. And if the United States plays a very decisive role protecting Israel and even perhaps participating in attacks together with Israel, then the U.S. will also become a target, and that will drag the United States into the war.
That was Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Find a link to his recent article titled "The Middle East is Inching Toward Another War" and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At 90 years old, Ralph Nader, America's leading public interest lawyer, continues to dedicate his life and energy to the struggle for social justice and making the concept of democracy real for all Americans. Nader, a best-selling author who ran for president four times as both a Green Party and independent candidate, has always used his platform to advocate for consumer and worker protections, environmental stewardship, while demanding the responsible regulation of corporate America's massive power. In his 60 years of activism, Nader was instrumental in passing automobile safety laws that save countless lives and called for the creation of government agencies, including the EPA, OSHA, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Nader also founded a wide range of civil society groups that have organized citizens to take a direct role in demanding corporate and government accountability. Ralph Nader's newest book is titled Let's Start the Revolution: Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country That Works for the People. Here he talks about the book, which focuses on the Democratic Party's reliance on corporate campaign funds that isolates it from the priorities of America's working families, and his prescription on how to counter Donald Trump and the Republican Party's phony populism.
So this book is a really very, very practical 2024 book for any candidates that want to subordinate corporate power, corporate coercion, corporate domination of our political economy and culture and families to the supremacy of citizens, of everyday people, of workers, consumers, communities. And so it's a very, very practical book. It goes through the history of how the Democratic Party kept scapegoating everybody but themselves for their inability to landslide the worst Republican Party in history, abandoning half the country to turn it into red states. Imagine that. You start out abandoning half the country, losing the gerrymandering race, surrounding the candidates with corporate conflicted political consultants, and on and on. So we're in this predicament where these races are razor thin, decided presidentially by the Electoral College, where the Democrats have lost twice, 2000 and 2016. They won handily the national votes, but lost the Electoral College vote. And they still didn't pick up to try to neutralize the Electoral College with this independent movement started by Steve Silberstein in San Francisco, which gets laws passed, including Connecticut and New York, I might add, to say that they will give the Electoral College vote to any presidential candidate on the ballot that wins the national vote. And they still won't get behind that. So this book is a long series of stories and recommendations how to have a progressive agenda. It doesn't just address the Democratic candidates. Any candidate would benefit from this book if they want to run with the people, for the people, of the people, by the people, instead of by giant corporations and their doctrine of supreme commercial corporatism.
And Ralph, you address in your book the concern that the Republican Party and Trump, and this precedes Trump before he entered politics, that the GOP has promoted a form of phony populism, emphasizing family values while actually waging war on families in the form of defunding, you know, valuable government programs that are genuinely helping families. At the same time, they're advocating huge tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans and these profitable corporations. Tell us a little bit about what your advice would be to Kamala Harris running against Trump this year, and what prescription in terms of countering this phony populism that seems to capture millions of votes?
Well, it's pretty easy to expose the Republicans. I mean, the fact that they've stolen the word populism from the Democrats is just an example of how weak the Democrats are. Populism arose in the 1890s with the farmers' agrarian revolt against the big railroads and the banks. The essence of populism is to take away power from giant corporations and put it back into people's hands, the sovereignty of we the people that the preamble of the Constitution starts with. The populism of the GOP is just rhetoric. They're trying to basically say, you know, hey, these elites and so forth. They don't get very specific. You say to these Republicans, okay, so you say you're populist. Why are you freezing the federal minimum wage at $7.25? Why are you cutting corporate taxes far, far more than the taxes on individuals, even working people, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, etc., pay a higher tax rate than the most profitable giant corporations by a long measure? And you got Southern Republican governors who have deliberately stripped people from having Medicaid for their family and kids that the federal government is paying 90% of. And then you say, populism is supposed to encourage people to vote. Instead, you're doing everything to purge votes, to obstruct voters, to make it harder to register voters, harder to do absentee ballots, harder to vote in any way. You're basically corporatism. You're the party of corporatism. You believe corporations should decide everything for ourselves, including the government.
That was Ralph Nader, America's leading public interest lawyer and four-time Green Party and independent presidential candidate. Learn more about Nader's new book titled Let's Start the Revolution and find links to his weekly column by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. American Indian Movement activist Leonard Peltier has been in federal prison for almost 50 years after being convicted in the 1975 killing of two FBI agents, Ronald Williams and Jack Kohler, which occurred on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. On July 2nd, 79-year-old Peltier, who has always maintained his innocence, was denied parole for the third time, meaning he will likely die in prison unless President Biden commutes his sentence. Peltier's trial was riddled with irregularities, and the government has admitted it doesn't know who killed the FBI agents. Indigenous peoples organizations have campaigned for Peltier's release for decades and have been joined by human rights groups and individuals around the world, including Amnesty International, the American Association of Jurists, the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, and Mother Teresa. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Justin Mazzola, Deputy Director of Research with Amnesty International USA, who's been following Peltier's case for years. Here he discusses the next steps that must be taken to win Leonard Peltier's freedom.
We originally sent observers to his trial as well as his successive appeals all the way up to the early 90s. And so from the start, we've had concerns about whether or not Leonard had received a fair trial.
And I've covered it for many years. And from everything I know, it's clear that he did not receive a fair trial. He's always maintained his innocence. Two of the people who were also charged in the killings were acquitted based on self-defense. And now, over these many decades, some very key people in his prosecution and conviction have even come forward to say minimally he didn't get a fair trial, or he should perhaps be released at this point when he's almost 80 years old and, you know, has a lot of serious health problems. What can you say about the situation now? What's left for Leonard, if anything? I guess it's just clemency from the president, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's the fastest and, you know, easiest route for Leonard to achieve his release. There are legal maneuvers that Leonard's attorneys will be taking with regards to the parole commission's decision. You know, there is a review process and appeal process that I'm sure that they're going to be engaging in, but obviously that takes time. And that's one thing that Leonard really doesn't have much of anymore. He's nearly 80 years old. He has chronic health issues. You know, some are very serious and potentially could be fatal. And some are due to being in an institution for the past 50 years and being incarcerated for 50 years. So this really is the fastest route for Leonard to achieve freedom, is through a grant of clemency and commutation of his sentence from President Biden.
It seemed like the most likely actually would have been Trump, because he hates the FBI. But that didn't happen either.
No, it didn't. That was kind of our thinking as well, was that, you know, Trump could put a thumb in the eye to the FBI because of all of his issues with them by granting his release. But of course, with all the shenanigans that were happening with pardons and everything else under the Trump administration, I guess Leonard's case didn't rise to that level of scrutiny or corruption.
Yeah, that's the thing. One question is, what else, if anything, your organization plans to do about this case? Is there anything left to do?
We obviously pivoted once we knew that the parole hearing was going to be taking place. We had our members really since 2021, when the petition for clemency was initially submitted to the DOJ pardon attorney. We had our members from all around the world. Leonard's case is something that generates a lot of interest, not only from folks here in the U.S. but also internationally. Writing to the president and the DOJ pardon attorney, seeking commutation. We then pivoted, obviously, to target the parole commission and send appeals to their office in support of parole. And now we just reissued another urgent action towards the president to commute his sentence. And so we're trying to promote that and really generate more attention to the case, because this really is potentially his last hope. When you look at, some of the comments from the FBI, labeling him a murderous dog and, all these other things, it's really hypocrisy, because the government admits in court that they don't even know who killed Agent Kohler and Agent Williams, and their families deserve justice. That's, undeniable. And so does the family of Joe Stunz, who was also killed, who was an AIM member who was also killed that day during the shootout, for which there's been no accountability and no justice. But holding Leonard at this point is not justice. He never received a fair trial. That's proven. It's been proven over and over again. Like I said, the government doesn't even know who actually killed the agents, and I've stated this in court. And so for the FBI to continue to demonize him and push against his release at this point in time, it really is beyond the pale at this point. And so I really urge people to try to take action however they can, even if you have taken action before and written to the president. Educate folks about his case if they haven't heard about it, and try to get more people to raise this with the presidency, because this really is Leonard's last chance to obtain freedom.
That was Justin Mazzola, Deputy Director of Research with Amnesty International USA. Learn more about the campaign pressing President Biden to grant Leonard Peltier executive clemency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you catch your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.